All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. Lovely to see you again, Jim. And we are going to crack off with the preamble this week. It's kind of like follow on from last week in such, because we were talking about the World Cup being, being a biennial World Cup. That'll be the correct terminology. So this is kind of like, it's in parallel with that. So it's about the US women's national team. So they bounced back from their unexpected defeat in the Olympic gold medal match against Canada by playing South American minnows Paraguay, not once, but twice in 5 days, as they shipped 17 goals past them without conceding. And just this struck me as being a bit bizarre, really. Paraguay have no players playing in any of the recognised top European leagues and have never reached the World Cup finals. So my question to anyone associated with the women's game is, what on earth was the point in this? Was this a way for Vlatko Antonovsky, the coach of the US women's team, to paper over some of the cracks of the very subpar performances they've had in the last 12 months? You know, is there really no competitive games that they can play over two friendlies when there are no major competitions until 2023? So my point is, I think the international women's game needs a shake up to make them more relevant and more competitive. So maybe Arsene's right, but just wrong with the gender that it needs to be applied to. What do you think about this?
I know what this is about. This is about confidence. The Olympics is a massive tournament, isn't it? A lot of pressure on the US women's team. Their reputation over the past, I'd say, 5-10 years is pretty much untouchable. And they're expected to win things. Now, when you gear up emotionally, physically, for the big stage, and it doesn't quite come off like it did it for them against Canada, I think there is there's a real danger of the hangover becoming entrenched in your team. And I think one of the ways to dig yourself out of that hole is to kick the shit out of an inferior opponent, which is what they've done. So why would you play them twice in 5 days? Why would you? That is just so, that's to get them firing again and to get them feeling free and easy, getting them feeling superior again. That's what I think that's about.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct on that. And they're going through a little bit of a transitional period at the minute, aren't they? This sort of, you know, Megan Rapinoe's, like, I think she's about 36. You got Carly Lloyd, I think, is roughly the same age. I think Rapinoe might even be older than that. And then you've got Alex Morgan. She's getting on a little bit as well. So, you know, they've got players that are sort of in the sort of twilights of their career, and perhaps they're, you know, trying to sort of bring the new guard in, but they don't want to have like a baptism of fire and play sort of good teams and friendlies. So I think you're completely on the right lines there. It is just a massive confidence booster. And in a way, it kind of feels a bit like a bit hollow, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, I couldn't understand it. Like, I could understand playing two different teams in 5 days, or even if they're two different weak teams, but playing the same team twice and they beat them 8-0 and 9-0. It's just, it's such a hollow thing to do.
I think the first 8-0 would have been enough.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
I agree with you. Yeah. And there was a couple of examples of that in the cup this week, actually. A couple of high scoring games, man, which I'm sure we'll move on to later on. But yeah, it can do wonders for a big team success to do something like that, to really run up an inferior opposition. So I do understand the coaches thinking, but I also agree with you that two in the space of 5 days is excessive, really.
And that's the American sports mentality, isn't it? Running up scores. That happens a lot in a
lot of different sports.
Yeah. So that's another thing, it's a very American thing to do. All right, so we'll start off with the five things you might have missed. We'll start off with another football one. So there were quite dark protests at Oldham Athletic on Saturday during their home game to Hartlepool. Non-season ticket holders were not permitted to buy tickets, seemingly to deter any chance of the protest escalating. More than 500 fans protested against Moroccan owner Abdallah Lemsgam's running of the club, including carrying a mock coffin outside the ground, which I thought was pretty deep. Apparently, Lemsgam's tenure has been highly unpopular since his arrival at Boundary Park in 2018, with a combination of late payments of salaries, threats of player strikes, and threats of administration that have caused friction between the fans and the board. So, Jim, do you think that British football fans just hate their owners no matter who they are? Like, they don't get a good start often, do they? Especially the foreign owners. If it's somebody that's, you know, brought the club and, you know, they've supported the club all their life, they get a lot of leeway, don't they? But a lot of foreign owners that come into these clubs, they immediately get off to a bad start, don't they?
Well, that might be an oversimplification just based on the factors you've outlined there. If players aren't getting paid, there's threats of strikes going on. how can you expect your team to perform to the best of their ability if they don't even know where the next wage packet's coming from? I don't agree with the tone of the protest. Don't get me wrong. That just reminded me then of when Beckham got the red card in 98 and people were hanging effigies from trees. Yeah. It's completely excessive. It kind of reeks of immaturity, really. It's like, do you really want this guy to die because he's made a few questionable business decisions? And in Beckham's case, just flicked his leg out and Simeone rolled about 15 times to get him sent off. So obviously it's an overreaction, but it might be that they're justified, man, in terms of wanting him gone, not in terms of wanting him dead, obviously. I mean, you yourself as a Blues fan, you know what it's like to have owners who don't give a shit about the club and who are fully willing to use the football club that you followed since you were a boy to their own financial end. Surely you can empathise with that frustration.
I think the frustration is born from the fact that, yeah, generations of families have been following a football club, and then you get an owner that perhaps hasn't got any sort of emotional attachment to the club. They come in and they start really changing things up, you know, treating the football club like a business. And a lot of these sort of clubs are Oldham Athletic, like Birmingham City, like Portsmouth, that have had poor owners, Bradford City, Charlton.
Endless list.
Yeah, there is. And even like Derby and Reading recently. Reading are due to be docked 9 points for financial misdemeanors, breaking FFP regulations. Derby are going to be docked 12 points, apparently. I think that's already happened, actually. There's a lot of clubs that are in trouble that are not ran properly. But that is, once again, a huge topic for another day. So we'll move on to number two. This is a baseball one. Baseball, and it involves a massive MMA star. So Conor McGregor, he was a special guest at Wrigley Field, home to the Chicago Cubs, on Tuesday, as he threw the first pitch prior to their game against the Minnesota Twins. Unfortunately, it had to be one of the most horrendous pitches ever thrown at a baseball mound. Even worse than Donald Trump's ahead of a minor league baseball game in New Jersey, this after he'd flown a helicopter into center field. So did you manage to catch this?
You know what? This was the last thing on my list. I was catching up on the Cup highlights and the Premier League highlights this afternoon in the garden. And this was last on my list, but I got talking to India's mom and I didn't want to be rude. So if you can, just describe to me what happened, because am I right in thinking that he knocked out a fan or an umpire or something like that?
Nearly. Very, very. So basically he's throwing it up, I would say, about 5 yards right of the catcher. Usually, people, and they won't try and put any venom into it. They'll just kind of like get it straight, get it accurate. But he's really tried to fizz this ball in. And like, it's kind of like bounce, like at Wrigley Field, there's like a brick wall, like a low brick wall. And then the fans are just behind that. So I don't think they put the netting up. Usually they put netting up before the game. And I guess they didn't have it up, or prior to the game, they don't have it up. And it's just kind of like hit the top of the wall and sort of bounced off. And it was just like, all right, that was a bit of a bad throw. But afterwards, he was like, oh yeah, but it had if that would have been accurate, it would have been perfect. It had all the power behind it. I promise you, like it had really good. Really, and I was like, what are you talking about, man? Like
the classic detail is the helicopter onto the diamond. He must have took time out from the VMA awards to take his time out of Wrigley Field, man. But yeah, that is classic Conor McGregor. He is fast becoming a caricature, man. And when you think about he was the man about 5 years ago. I'm intrigued to watch him on a celebrity level. The way people in the late 90s, early 2000s must have been intrigued to watch Mike Tyson and just to see what's going to happen next, man. He's definitely in that area. So I'm going to check that out after the pod.
All right, number three, David Beckham's son, Romeo, makes his debut for Inter Miami's feeder club, Fort Lauderdale, in the third tier of American football, or American soccer. He actually started alongside former Manchester United player Phil Neville's son, who has already racked up around 16 appearances for the club. Neville is also currently the head coach at Inter Miami, who currently sit ninth in the Eastern Conference. So do you think this is a bit of a PR stunt, or do you actually think the kid can ball?
From what I'm hearing, he didn't get a great reception, did he?
I'm not sure about his reception. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I can't imagine there's that many fans going to a Fort Lauderdale game, really. Probably maybe 500 or something.
A couple of things popped up on my YouTube and that. And obviously, you have to bear in mind that because it's Beckham's son, there's either going to be a propensity from fans to love him or just slate him down. Do you know what I mean? So he's never going to get a lukewarm response, is he? It's kind of like a Campbell Hatton, Connor Benn, Chris Eubank. You know what I mean? When you're in the shadow of your dad, there's always going to be that reaction.
Yeah.
So I think publicity at this stage it's going to do more harm than good, really.
I was thinking that as well, yeah.
So how are you meant to... I mean, even academy players who are, like, shit hot, do you know what I mean? If they're, like, they're the next big thing, you really don't see much of them until they start playing in proper games. And if he's got a whirlwind of social media speculation about him now, and he's not even doing... He's playing in, like, America in the third-tier team or whatever like that. I don't think it's that good for him, his mentality, his development. Or, you know, time can tell. He's got the genetics, so... I don't know.
Like, how often have we seen this with sort of like the ex-legends bringing their sons out or bringing the sons into the club that they are associated with? A couple that struck me was Zinedine Zidane's son. He's the main one that sprung to mind. Enzo, I think his name is. He was playing for Real Madrid C and B teams for years, but never made a first team appearance. I think he's now playing second division football in France. Georgi Hagi's son, I think his name's Ionis, the great Romanian attacking midfielder who played for Barca and Real Madrid, all-time Romanian top goal scorer. His son plays for Rangers, but hasn't quite matched the heights of his dad yet. I think only about 22 years old. But are there any that spring to mind immediately for you? Sort of like legends that have tried to bring in their son, you know, into the club and give him a chance, but they never really matched the same sort of heights?
No, it kind of brought the inverse to mind for me. I was always thinking, look, there are so many impediments to success at the top level of football. And as the son of a legend, you might get the opportunities. It's a big ask to replicate your dad's form in any kind of sporting arena.
Yeah.
And especially football, team game, all that kind of stuff. But it brought to mind for me, apparently Ronaldinho's brother is the one that got him into football. And apparently he was like, my brother was sick. He's like, he used to kick the ball about with me, tell me little things and bring me to the games and all that kind of stuff. And no one's ever heard of Ronaldinho's big brother. So I thought the inverse is probably true. If you've got a less successful elder sibling or a dad and you learn about the graft early on in your life, you're much more likely to succeed. Whereas if you're like Beckham's son, like Maldini's son, like Zidane's son, they cast a big shadow, don't they, man? So you might have the technical ability, but there's also that thing in the back of your mind, lot of pressure from the very earliest days. So I think that has a negative impact, but I wouldn't rule it out entirely. But I can't think of any famous examples of where the son has gone on to eclipse the dad's achievements.
Yeah, not many at all. Obviously, there's probably a few from, you know, maybe that you do hear about it. Oh, his dad used to play for like Preston or whatever, and now he's playing for England, this and that. So it does happen, but in the modern age, it doesn't. For me, it's not immediately striking me as any players really that have done it. Even Andy Cole, Devante Cole, I think he's playing in the Championship, so he's not
right.
Quite
Sean Wright Phillips, maybe.
Yeah, potentially.
Still not a patch on his old man.
No. Nope.
So again, sticking with football, quite noteworthy in terms of. In the modern environment of expressing your views and in terms of getting in trouble for what you say, I think Chelsea's left-back Marcus Alonso has made quite a brave stand here. He said he's going to refuse to take the knee before kickoff as a stand against racism because he thinks it's losing its strength as a gesture. He said instead he'll remain standing and point to the no room for racism badge on his sleeve, which, you know, you can't get confused about his stance. But I think that's right on, man. I think you're really in danger of taking the knee automatically and then you forget what the whole thing's about. It's like, do you remember those wristbands back in the day?
Mm.
Like anti-racism, anti-sexism, and then they just became like a fashion accessory.
Yeah.
You sell it at JD Sports and you're getting free with your trainers and all that bollocks. Like, it's that kind of thing. I think he's put himself out there and, you know, he plays for a big club. I'm sure he's got a lot of sponsorship deals. I'm sure he's got a lot of things up in the air that he's potentially jeopardising by saying this. I think hats off to him, man. I think I didn't expect that from someone in the Premier League, really.
Yeah, I think it's a clever move as well. I think it's taking the power away from the fans that are booing the knee as well. Mm. So it's taking the spotlight away from that a little bit because that's always the topic of conversation. Whenever you hear the commentator say, all right, the players are going to take a knee in the stand against racism. All right, yeah, we understand what the gesture meant now. But as you say, it has lost, it's become completely diluted now, hasn't it? Like, it's completely lost its meaning. There's been so many players now that said, like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to force people to do it. I'm not going to expect people to do it. So the fact that he's just, you know, he agrees that there is no room for racism, that is it. But it has lost its meaning. I think we do need to start to move on from it now, generally.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? We understand that our society needs to do a better job of addressing, you know, social issues. So I think we all understand that now. It played its part. Even if we just have, like, as you say, standing there pointing at the badge, that's fine. It's the same gesture gets across the same message for me. it hasn't been as sort of, you know, as not obvious a stance, but, you know, I feel like we need to move on from it now.
Yeah, it's still perfectly clear, man. But number five, this harkened back to a few weeks ago, another marathon-related debacle. During the Great Bristol Run, Omar Ahmed took a wrong turn where the 10K and half marathon courses converged. He ended up running an extra 12K and finished 5 minutes ahead of the competition with a time of 1 hour, 3 minutes and 8 seconds. Obviously, organisers disqualified him.
Was he on the juice or what?
I can't believe those fucking dickheads disqualified him. So, mate, you've won. He's ran the distance. I read the article and they're like, yeah, well, you know, rules is rules. It's like, mate, you won the race.
So he actually tracked back, like, went back on himself.
So there's two courses, the 10K and the half marathon, right? Yeah, he was on the 10K and he's took a wrong turn and he's ended up on the half marathon and he's ended up blitzing the competition. Obviously, in a shorter race, you're setting a hotter pace, aren't you?
Yeah.
And he's just carried on that pace and left everyone else in the dust. And they've punished him for it. They've punished him for athletic achievement because he didn't sign the right form at the beginning of the race. The fucking pricks.
Oh, that is so slack. That is so slack.
No, absolutely. So this has been galling me ever since I found out about that. So what is the problem?
Losing sleep at night, like. All right, so that'll be it for the five things you might have missed. We're going to move straight into the footy talk and we're going to start with the UEFA fine that has been given to Hungary, which is some pocket change for a country, I'd assume. And they've been given a one-game behind doors ban for racially abusing England players. So they've been fined €184,000 by FIFA, which is one of the largest financial penalties ever handed out. So FIFA's disciplinary committee ruled that there had been racist behaviour of numerous supporters during their match against England earlier this month, which included monkey chants towards players Raheem Sterling and Jude Bellingham. Hungarian fans supposedly used racist words and actions, threw objects, lit fireworks and blocked stairways at the Puskás Arena in Budapest, FIFA said in a statement. So once again, and we have mentioned this on the podcast in the past, like, is this really going to change the perceptions or the feelings or, you know, the outlooks of these Hungarian fans, a one game behind doors ban?
Well, no, because you're not going to, first of all, you're not seriously hindering their National Football Federation. You're not really punishing them. Like you say, they've got that money in their back pocket. It's more about FIFA saying, oh, we're doing something to stand up against racism. Like you see on the badge, it's like we were just talking about with Marcus Alonso, the badges are on the shirts, man. They've made an organizational stand against racism. But if you're really against racism, you'd come up with harsher measures, a stricter disciplinary plan. Now, look, you're not going to address racism through a sporting body or a sporting organization handing out mediocre fines to someone. It's just not going to happen. So they're just trying to save face, basically. You're not going to, if all Hungarian fans are racist, this isn't the measure to stop them being racist, is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think there needs to be some part of the Hungarian Football Federation that need to really identify the fans that were directly involved in the incidents. And they need to be banned for life. Like, do what, you know, Premier League clubs would do in those instances. If they could identify fans that had been, you know, doing monkey chants at Chelsea games, like which there has been in the past, like, those people would directly be affected. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, it's a very small proportion. It always is, of football fans that are attached to certain clubs or certain countries that are, you know, that are part of this racist behaviour, this racist rhetoric. So just get rid of them, get them out of there. Well, they should be identified and make sure that they don't attend a football game ever again. There should be a no compliance with racism at all.
At the risk of sounding like an apologist, I do think we have to take into consideration that different countries do things different ways. Now, I'm not sure if the measures that we've taken as a country, which have worked, I think, if you go back to the racist hooligan days of the 80s and the 70s, I know we still have a bit of trouble now and again, especially when we go abroad, but it's unrecognisable. Do you know what I mean? The game, the governing bodies and especially the fucking government in this country have taken measures that have been really effective. And I think bans, lifetime bans, international travelling bans have been the most successful. So I would assume, the same as you would, that those are the measures that Hungary need to take to stomp this kind of behavior out. But I'm not sure, I'm not 100% sure that it will work, because different countries, different people, different circumstances. I would assume, again, that it would work, but I'm not 100% certain.
Do you think the anti-racism campaigns that have been developed through football, has that led to a change in the way we view racism and social issues in society as a whole? Has it been down specifically to the anti-racism campaigns in football, or do you think it's just been because as a society we've sort of become more aware that we need to be careful about how we approach people, the language we use, and just generally sort of being a bit more open-minded when it comes to different societal issues? Do you think it's down to football, or do you think it's down to society in general?
Well, because sport, and especially football in this country, is such a massive part of society, I think if that message, that anti-racism message, is coming through football, I think it can't help but affect the conversation in a positive way. I mean, if you grow up, if you're 8-9 years old and your heroes are on some anti-racist shit from day one, young kids are going to identify with that, man. And they're going to say, okay, he did that. My hero is like that, so I'm going to be like that. Of course, it's going to have a positive, as we see it, positive effect.
So the last word on this, would, if you were the head of the disciplinary proceedings or whoever is in charge of making these decisions about how these countries should be disciplined, what would your approach be to this?
I think I'd be along your lines. I think I'd come down on them like a ton of bricks, man.
Competitions. So ban them from the next World Cup finals. Yeah.
Ban them from the next two. I would come down on them like a ton of bricks, man. But the thing is, same old, same old. There's money to be made. There's compromises to be made. You want to get fans in the stadiums. You want to get people, especially a place like Hungary, their economy is not great. The political system's quite corrupt, same as ours. But, you know, the economy is not bad. So it exacerbates that aspect of it. So I think sport and large-scale sporting events are good to keep the populace happy. So I think it's an uphill battle, kicking people out in general. I think if you're just going to put Hungary behind closed doors, those lads are in the stands chucking beers at Raheem Sterling, they're going to be doing something else. And I think they'd rather them in the stands, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to leave that. So we'll move on to the Premier League game results. We're not going to read them all off, but we'll just pick a few sort of key moments and a few key good performances. The one that sprung out to me was Brighton Hove Albion. And again, we've mentioned, you know, we're not surprised at how well they're doing this season. They beat Leicester 2-1. I think they move up to sixth in the table, is it, as the close of players, we move into the next weekend's fixtures. But what a result for them, man.
Mate, you say we're not surprised, but this is all you're doing. That whole expected goal thing, that whole, like, they're creating so many chances, but they're just not converting them. This was all your theory, man. This would have been complete. This would have been in the abyss in the back of my mind, not even registering. You called this in January, man. This is one of the
I wish I would have had a fucking bet on it as well. Like, do you know what I mean? All the shit that I actually predict, I don't have a fucking bet on.
But it could have carried on like they were going. Do you know what I mean? Carried on creating chances. They could have got relegated. So this is just working out, and it is turning around, man. And they're turning into, I mean, a win against Leicester. Leicester are a bad boy team. Mm. To even dig out any kind of result, even if it's half lucky, that is a good result for a team like Brighton, man. What do you expect from Brighton moving forward? Do you think they can sustain the results they've been having early season?
I mean, you'd have to just base it on what they were doing last season and what they're doing differently this season. I don't think they've made too many major signings. They've kind of kept the same core team. If I remember rightly, when we're going through the transfer news, I don't think they made any major signings, but they've kept their main players, Neil Maupay, scoring the goals. They've got the lad that I can't remember his name in the centre midfield, who said he was the Bissouma, who said he was the best midfielder in the Premier League. So he doesn't lack any confidence. Fair play to him. But you know, that game against Leicester, it proves how competitive the Premier League is, because Leicester's goal was absolutely incredible. To score a goal of that caliber and then be on the losing team, for me, it shows you the quality that is in the Premier League. Even in certain games like that, where you're not talking about teams that are in the big six, even though Leicester should be, well, they're on the cusp of it. But for them to get beat 2-1 and score a goal of that caliber really shows you sort of like how much quality is that there is in the Premier League.
I can't believe Welbeck's still scoring goals. And I can't, that Maupay, is that you say
yeah,
his name?
Yeah, Neil Maupay, yeah.
He's like, what's his name that just went to Villa? Danny Ings. That's what he's like. he's going to carry on chipping away. I mean, what did he get last season? Was it 10, 12, something like that in the Premier League?
Yeah.
Something like that. Wasn't it? And they weren't scoring as many goals as they were supposed to. So a bit of a dark horse bet. He might be up there, man. 15, 20. Possible.
Yeah, I mean, they've got Adam Lallana as well, who obviously was at Southampton, played at Liverpool for a few years. Didn't really do it at Liverpool, but he's gone there now and he's playing some good stuff. Cucurella, I think they signed from Barcelona, who was, you know, I think he was in the Spain squad in the Euros. So they've got some good players in their team, man. And, you know, they're beating teams. They're just about edging teams, but they're scoring the goals that they perhaps weren't scoring last season. So it's going to be impressive to see whether they can maintain that and maybe get, like, I think definitely a top half finish, as I see it for now. But we'll move on to United. So United managed to edge West Ham 2-1 after David De Gea, I think it was a 95th minute penalty, was it?
Mark Noble
penalty. And they were like, Mark Noble doesn't miss penalties. And then David De Gea, like, fair play to him, got up and saved it.
I'm quite happy for De Gea because he was there, a very, very young keeper, 22, 23, coming into the main stage at Old Trafford. And he was like, that's high praise. Not the next Schmeichel, but he is the next guy that we can depend on in the Old Trafford goal. And then he had two or three seasons flirting with Real Madrid, you know, as it always does. That kind of distraction translates to poor form. Maybe we'll get onto that with Harry Kane in a little bit. But, you know, he's been beyond reproach since Man United have been on this resurgence. You know, I'm really, really happy for him, man. He's got probably 8-9 years left in the game to pull off something like that. So picturesque, especially after the result against Young Boys last week. You know what I mean? I'm really, really happy for him, man. Again, Ronaldo. Again, Lingard as well.
Yeah, I mean, what a goal. I was about to mention that. What a goal from Lingard. By the way, can you believe David De Gea has been at United for 10 years now?
Usually, keepers start, they're like 26, 27. I was thinking, that's a lot of pressure, man, for a young lad like that. And, you know, fair play to him, man. He stuck it out. He's probably turned down a few big moves, man. Big contract moves as well.
Well, he nearly had that move to Real Madrid, didn't he? Where I think the only thing that needed to happen was the contract to be faxed over, but they didn't get it done in time. That was a few years ago, wasn't it? But since then, obviously he's had his troubles. He's been dropped. I think Dean Henderson come in last at the end of last season and played a lot of games. So he's got himself back into the first team now, and it looks like he's starting to play some of his best football. But Jesse Lingard, yeah, what a finish. And what do you make of him? What do you make of him not celebrating? Obviously, he was at West Ham for, what, half a season since, was he a January signing at the end of last season and played about half the season last year for West Ham?
He got a lot of love at West Ham, didn't he?
And he's reinvigorating himself, hasn't he, really? Because he hadn't scored for 2 years in the league. He wasn't even getting in the squad at United. He's gone to West Ham. David Moyes gave him a chance. He's gone there, proved his worth, scored goals. So I think that's probably justified why he didn't celebrate. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You know what I mean? Like, if your confidence is in the dumps and you're feeling bad about yourself, you're feeling doubting yourself about your career, he's still a young man, you know? Do you know what I mean? Mid-20s. You know, a lot of uncertainty in your life about your career, about where you're going, about your aspirations, what's happened versus what you expected. And he's gone to West Ham and he's like, oh my God, I'm still the player. I'm still the player everyone thought I was. He was throwing up hammer signs 3 weeks in when he went to West Ham. Do you know what I mean? So I can completely understand and I support his decision. I actually like the fact that he showed him that amount of respect, even after scoring a banger. So fair play to him as well.
And the last sort of in-depth one we'll talk about is Chelsea. What a result for them. Tottenham, who had won about 4 games on the bounce, 1-0 or something, I think. Chelsea have gone there and just dismantled them, really. I think all 3 goals from set pieces. But look at the people that scored. Antonio Rudiger, N'Golo Kante.
It was a deflection, wasn't it? Was it Kante's one?
Kante's one was a big deflection. Thiago Silva was a header, I think. And then Rudiger's was just a nice finish, man. Like, it wasn't a centre-back's finish at all, but it just shows you how good Thomas Tuchel's been since he's gone in there. I think I read a stat the other day. They've kept more clean sheets than won games or something. I can't remember what it was exactly. I'll have to get the stat up in a sec. But they've just been absolutely fantastic since he's took over. Tottenham are going to be a little bit disappointed with that. No one wants to get beat by a London rival. But, you know, my 50 quid on Chelsea to win the league is looking better by the minute.
Well, I'll ask you a question now because I was just listening to it. Graham Souness, Roy Keane, Michael Richards, they're all talking about Harry Kane and Tottenham afterwards. And they seem caught in two minds, really. A lot of contradictions going on in that post-match analysis. So on one hand, they're saying, okay, Kane's coming deeper to get the ball now, which means he's not getting as many goal-scoring opportunities up top, which is a bad thing because he's not in the box. But then Roy Keane's saying, yeah, but you need to get hold of the ball and do something, be aggressive, maybe get the ball, lay it off, make a run. I think, is the question I'm getting to, is Tottenham's midfield that bad that Kane, first of all, feels the need to drop deep and then doesn't feel the need to get forward quite as urgently? Is the service that bad at Spurs? Or
I don't think it's an issue with the personnel at Tottenham, because we spoke about him doing the exact same thing during the Euros for England. It's obviously a player trait. He's obviously, you know, naturally dropping in to receive the ball. For whatever reason, he's been coached to do that by whether it's Southgate that's been telling him to do it, whether it was sort of Mourinho when he was at Spurs, whether he was coaching him to do it, to drop deep. And then, but the thing is, he's getting the ball right. So what are his options from there? If he plays a long diagonal out to the right winger or whatever, he's dropped into that sort of like that hole in between the sort of, you know, left back and centre back to pick up the ball around the halfway line. And then he's pinging a ball out to the right winger. Who's making the run now? Yeah, who's making the run
get in
into
there.
The box?
He's got a buster gut to get in there if he's doing that. And here's the thing as well. He's not Rooney in that he has that ability to spray that ball 40 yards, no bother. But if he's not busting a gut to get on the end of it when the return cross comes, that's a problem. So I think that's kind of what they were getting at. But they were annoying me in the fact that like they couldn't seem to come to an agreement. Graeme Souness was like, this is just what older players do. They look for the easier areas to get into. There might be a little bit of that, but
it's 28. Maybe
that's what they were saying. But at the same time, we've been talking about it 60 game seasons from day one, isn't it? So he might not be old in terms of his age, but he might be old in terms of how many minutes he's played, how many miles he's ran, all that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, I said to you a couple of weeks ago, Daniel Levy's played a blinder here, keeping Kane. And now I'm not so sure. But then again, he scored in the cup midweek. So, do you know what I mean?
The thing is, he's there to put the ball in the back of the net, man. Like, he can score from outside the box. He can score with headers. He can assist goals. Yeah, he can do all that. We know he can do all that. But Tottenham at the moment, they've got Højbjerg and like Ndombele. They're kind of like two centre-mids. Obviously, they've got players like Oliver Skipp that can come off the bench, Harry Winks. They've got a bit of quality. But for me, Højbjerg and Ndombele, they're not particularly players that are going to play that killer pass, or like, you know, they're not really going to open up a defence. You know, they're not really going to spray the ball around that well. So they're more destroyers in the middle of the park for me, in my view of them. I could be wrong. Obviously, people that watch these two players play a little bit more would know that. But Højbjerg, fantastic player, had a great Euros for Denmark. I think he's been a really good signing for Tottenham. But as you say, do you need to play centre mid? If Harry Kane's doing this and he's dropping in the midfield to pick up the ball and spray a pass, do you really need to have two centre mid? So it's a real tactical conundrum for Espirito Santo to work out. And I think they do need to work out, because they've got away with the results they've had so far. Those like sneaky little 1-0 wins. Do you know what I mean?
3-1-0s. Apparently, there was no goals from open play. No, 1 in 5 goals from open play or something like that. But I would argue, from a coach's perspective, obviously it's easy me sitting here talking bollocks from someone who doesn't even watch all the football there is to be watched. But surely you can turn Kane's habits, his natural inclinations, into a positive for the team. If he's willing to come deep and he has that ability to pass 40 yards, cut across the pitch, surely they can do something with that, man. Surely there's another player who can fill in that gap, or a midfielder who can run from. I'm sure they can do that. So again, I don't want to be too hard on Kane. We've bollocked him enough over the summer. He was scoring goals all throughout, do you know what I mean? All throughout the Euros. And it's like, we gave him a hard time all the way through, and he was still basically doing his job, even though he wasn't on top form. So I think with Tottenham, if you've got a big squad, and if you're looking for top six, which is probably what Tottenham are looking at, you can do something with that. I'm sure they can.
Yeah, or every single Premier League midfielder, centre midfielder, realistically should be able to play those sort of passes. And when you need a player like Harry Kane to be, you know, playing in the gaps between the sort of defence and midfield, trying to receive, playing give and goes with the players that, you know, the midfielders that are coming through, the attacking midfielders and et cetera, playing between the lines, trying to make runs, trying to get on the end of crosses. That's what we want to see from Harry Kane. I think that's what Spurs fans want to see from Harry Kane. So I think there needs to be certain tactical direction, you know, given to Kane from the coach. And then he needs to come out and say, look, look, you need to do your job as a striker. So we'll move on from that. We'll sort of reel off some of the results. Some of the other results are Brentford, great result for them. You know, they've had a really good first Premier League campaign. So, you know, beat Wolverhampton Wanderers, who have been really, you know, quite terrible since Nuno, who we just spoke about, left. Arsenal back to winning ways. They needed that desperately, didn't they?
Skin of their teeth as well, man. Skin of their teeth. Odegaard with a monster free kick. Couldn't have come at a better time. I watched that Tifo football thing midweek talking about Sean Dyche's Burnley and about how the way he sets his team up is basically the antidote to what Arsenal do. So they did really well to get a result there. Again, compounded by results by the cup in midweek. I'm happy enough to bollock Arsenal when things don't go their way. I am more than happy to celebrate a 1-0 win and a 3-0 win this week. This is, if you're going to turn things around, this is the start of it. So fingers crossed. I said, I don't want to say too more because we've spent more than enough time on Arsenal over the past few weeks, man.
Yeah, like Turf Moor is a difficult place to go. Sean Dyche is a, you know, he sets up his team, as you said, difficult to break down. Very, very defensive minded. And, you know, they're one of the best at it really in the Premier League of, you know, taking pressure and you know, making it difficult for teams to break them down. So that is a good result for Arsenal. No, which way you look at it, it's a good result. It's a win. It's 3 points for Arteta and the pressure is alleviated off him at least for a couple of weeks. Liverpool win 3-0. No surprises there. Man City, after Pep Guardiola's plea to the fans to come and support their team, which the board didn't like. I'm not sure if it was a sellout or not, but they sort of, you know, struggle a little bit to Southampton. I think they had only one shot on target, 16 attempts or something like that. So they struggled a little bit against Southampton. What do you make of that?
It's not like City, that is it?
One not shot at all. On target. At home, you guarantee them to get at least, what, two or three goals minimum, don't you? So it's a bit of a weird one for Man City, that is. They haven't sort of been flying on all cylinders, have they, start the season?
I'll call it now, man. I reckon Pep's going to go at the end of the season.
Well, no, he's already announced, hasn't he, that he's going after 2 years. Yeah, 2 years, he said.
But... Oh, no, 2 years, but I reckon... No, no, I remember now you've said it, man. But I think end of the season, I think they're going to... I think he's going to call it, man. I think he's going to call it at the end of the season. But how much... Look.
If they don't win the Champions League and they don't win the Premier League, there's a perfectly good avenue for him to say, like, yeah, I said 2 years, but I think my time's done here. I said I'd win the Champions League, but, you know, I might have to sort of bow out and give someone else a chance.
He's got nothing to be ashamed of.
He's done brilliantly there, yeah.
Look at what he's done there, man. Man City fans should be kissing his fucking feet, as far as I'm concerned. I know he's come into a team that's got a lot of money behind them and there's already a legacy of building up the squad, but look, come on. They've been outstanding under him. And if he wants to go after it, yeah, which I think he will, because I think this Champions League thing is becoming a bit of a poison chalice, man. And I think you need to fucking, you know, shit will get off the pot, basically.
It's such a difficult thing to do. And I know he's spent like over £1 billion on transfers, whatever it is. You know, he has spent a, you know, monumental amount of money to try and win that Champions League. And that's what the owners want, ideally. They're in the same position as PSG. They're expected to get to the final, really, of the Champions League every year now with the amount of money that's been pumped into the team and the amount of quality they've got at their disposal. So that is the sort of the bare minimum expectation for teams like Manchester City and PSG. But he's done fantastically there. No Man City would begrudge him if he left at the end of the season without winning Champions League title. So Watford, they won 3-1 away at Norwich. Norwich, I think that's 5 losses on the bounce now. I'm not sure how they did in the cup last night, but
lost 3-0, man.
They're struggling. They're struggling big time. And we always knew they would. They're one of the yo-yo teams, aren't they? A little bit like Fulham. That sort of up and down, West Brom. You know, there's those teams that do just enough in the Championship to get promoted, but then they don't really spread their resources, or they don't really try and spend too much money to stay in the league. So you can see them being, well, you'd put good money on them to get relegated at the end of the season, even finishing bottom. And then Villa 3-0, fair play to Villa. We were singing Everton's praises last week.
Them. Absolutely cursed them, and they lost in the cup as well.
So there you go, Villa. You know, I think Villa needed that win as well. They haven't had the best of starts to the season. Leon Bailey got his first goal. Great finish. I think he got an assist as well. So Villa looked very, very good, I have to say. So it's good to see them doing well. Danny Ings playing well as well, linking up with play. So yeah, great 3-0 result for one of our Midlands teams. All right, so that's it for all the Premier League games. Oh, by the way, Jim, that stat was Chelsea have more Premier League clean sheets, 15, than they've conceded goals, 14, in the Premier League under Thomas Tuchel. How incredible is that? More clean sheets than they've conceded goals.
But PSG are fucking kicking themselves at them, man.
Oh, they let go of a good one there. You know, he's really proved himself to be one of the top managers in Europe. So talking of Europe, we'll move on to the European leagues. We'll have a quick fire blast through these. Juventus are suffering from post-Rooney syndrome as they languish in the relegation zone after managing only 2 points from four games. I think this has changed since last night, that they did get a win last night, a 3-2 win, comeback win. So they've moved up to 5 points now, just outside the relegation zone, but still a very, very bad start to the season for Juventus. Napoli, on the other hand, have 100% win rate so far with their impressive 4-0 victory on Monday night. Have you watched any Italian league this year?
I've been watching a little bit more.
AC Milan, isn't it? You've been watching old Ante Rebic getting on the score sheet, yeah.
But you're always going to suffer if Ronaldo leaves your team. And also, I think last season, Juventus weren't really firing, were they? So 2 from 4 is not really that surprising to me. They're still going to finish in like European like places, aren't they? Really, man. And Napoli might be up there as well, man, to be fair.
I think last season, they just about managed to get qualification for the Champions League, didn't they? I think they finished 4th on the last game of the season or something like that. Yeah. So they, you know, they missed out on the title last year after doing, 9 years on the trot. And now they're in jeopardy of, you know, perhaps not doing it again, you know. So they're not really the powerhouse that they once were in the Italian League, are they?
Well, that's all relative. There's always going to be three teams, isn't there? Inter, AC, Juve. I mean, who else is there?
Napoli are bouncing about there. I wonder if they can really push on.
Yeah, there's going to be Napoli, Fiorentina. Who else now? It's a top-heavy league, isn't it? Is the point I'm trying to make. Yeah. It's like Spain. It's like a bit like Germany as well. Very top-heavy. Even if you have the worst season in your clubs, like you say, winning nine on the trot, finishing 4th, all of a sudden you're a bad team. But look, you're 2-3 signing. No, not at all. You're 2-3 signings away. You've still got the sponsorship money coming in. You've still got the income. You've still got the reputation. They'll be fine, man.
So on the same night last week, Barcelona needed a late goal to avoid complete embarrassment at home to Granada. The game ended 1-1 thanks to a late goal from Ronald Araujo as Barca finished the game with Gerard Piqué and Luke de Jong as their front two. What is going on at Barcelona? Like, you know, I feel like Koeman's absolutely losing the pot. They've yet to win since he came out with a statement, thanks to me, this club has a future.
We spoke about the club-wide situation at Barcelona many a time. And I think Koeman deserves a lot of credit for even churning out draws, to be honest with you. I mean, can you imagine the pressure he's getting from both sides, from the players, from the man, from the fans, from everyone, the questions course, from the media, everyone, every constantly, what's going on, it takes a certain type of personality to withstand that barrage from all sides. So that is an egotistical statement, I'll grant you, but I think there's some truth to it.
So Real Madrid, on the other hand, scored two very late goals to edge past Valencia to retain their place at the top of the table. Goals from Vinicius Junior and club legend Karim Benzema did the business, and he scored as many goals as Barcelona have total this season. I think 8 goals already. So
Benzema.
Yeah, I think so. I'm sure I read that stat earlier. I'm always reading stats on Twitter. Half the time I get them wrong.
I think Asensio scored a hat-trick midweek as well. I think they beat someone 6-1. Last night or the night before. So yeah. Real Madrid are flying, man. They're absolutely flying.
And to continue the trend of late goal flurries from the big European sides, PSG scored a 93rd minute winner courtesy of Mauro Icardi to ensure their 100% start to the season. And remarkably, last night they did it again, 95th minute to beat Metz, as Ashraf Hakimi scored 2 goals. So what a signing he's turned out to be. And, you know, all this without Lionel Messi. So, what, you know, realistically, what do they need Lionel Messi for? They've won 7 on the bounce. This brought some solace and redemption to Pochettino after he had the cojones to take off Lionel Messi with 15 minutes to go in a crucial tie against Olympique Lyon midweek. Did you see this? Did you hear about this?
No, did you hear about this? No, but I know there's been a bit of controversy, as there obviously will be, about Messi being substituted here and there, about Rakimi being brought on. But, you know, I actually like the fact that he's playing the best hand that he thinks he's got. If he needs to make a change, he's going to make it. I actually like that about Pochettino. And again, okay, you might say two late winners on the bench is like really dramatic, but that's not a good sign for me, that you're digging results out against teams that you should really be smashing the life out of. So, you know, this could go one or two ways. Maybe this can be the catalyst to going towards Christmas, the new year. Maybe they can build on this. Or maybe this is like, they're already holding on. But, you know,
they've got the firepower. Yeah, they've got the firepower.
Yeah, of course they have. But they think they've got the firepower as well. I don't like that PSG team. It's full of wankers, man. Neymar's a little prick. Mbappe's a prick. Like, they're all fucking, they're all FIFA cover players, aren't they?
Yeah.
I don't like them at all, man. It's like you saying, man, it's like FIFA Ultimate Team. It's all for the 12-year-olds who are on about scoring free kicks in the 95th minute. I don't think that's the way, man. I think Messi's like the epitome of professionalism. Okay, maybe he's not fitting in the team. I'm not even making a case for him being in the team, but I'm just saying these are image players to me. They're image players.
And that's how they're generating their profits, aren't they? That's how they're generating the revenue streams, by having these players selling the shirts, you know, all the media sort of attention that comes with it. That's kind of more beneficial to them than getting results in the French league at the minute. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, obviously we know that PSG, their real main target is the Champions League. So that's what they're really competing in. Well, that's 0 goals in 3 games for Messi compared to Cristiano's start of 4 in 3. Or it might be more than that. But
now we'll give it time. No, like Messi's playing quite deep, isn't it? And I've noticed, I watched again a few videos where he's making the same runs that he would at Barcelona, and they'd pick him up at the edge of the box where the forward attackers are dragging the defenders deep, and then Messi's left with all that space. But Neymar's not even looking for the pass. Do you know what I mean? So it's a different style of play. Obviously, you can't expect PSG and the players they've got now to have the same level of understanding that Barca had with Messi, because they all grew up together. That's an unrealistic expectation. I completely understand that. But I think Messi not scoring yet for PSG is a little bit misleading.
And just on the note of keeping on the French league, there was something that I read. Lucas Paqueta, who plays for Olympique Lyon, I believe, he did a rainbow flick in his last game, right? And this is something that Neymar did last year. And the referee booked him for it.
What?
Yeah. The referee booked Lucas Paqueta for doing a rainbow flick. And
for a bit of skill.
Yeah. And something similar happened to Neymar about a year ago. And apparently Neymar's come out and said, like, yeah, it's a load of bollocks, basically. But yeah, supposedly the referee's booked him. I'm not sure if he called a foul at the same time. I'll have to sort of do a little bit more research into what exactly happened. I haven't seen the event, but I was just reading up about it. And yeah, he's got booked for doing a rainbow flick, which makes no sense to me.
No, I'd agree with Neymar though. That is a load of bollocks.
Yeah.
That is a load of bollocks. You're not endangering anyone. What are you doing? Showboating. What are you doing? Showing your skill in a game where basically your whole worth is dependent on your skill. What the... Sorry.
I think the offense comes from the fact that you're sort of demeaning the opponent in a way. Do you know what I mean? I guess it's not in the sort of ethics of the game.
Yeah, well, fuck them. If they can't stop it, I'm sorry, but if you can't stop that from happening, that's on you. Who was that player, that Brazilian player back in the day who used to juggle a ball on his head? Do you remember him?
It's probably Ronaldinho, to be fair.
No, it weren't. It was a little... He went nowhere in life. I think he I think he got signed to Inter Milan. And
Robinho?
No. He was a little, like, light-skinned Brazilian. I'll pull it up on my phone as we go on.
Oh, God knows. Yeah, try and figure it out. Oh, it's ringing a bell now.
No. I'll find it. Go on.
Yeah, find it.
Carry on, go on.
But yeah, that's ridiculous. It reminded me of there's a new rule in the NFL now where you get not reprimanded, your team gets cautions. Not, what's the word? Your team gets a foul against them. Basically, they lose 10 yards if you're taunting. If you taunt the opponent, so if you go in their face and you're like, yeah, what? If you just do that, something like that, the referee throws his little yellow flag and says, oh, like taunting 10 yards to the opponent and first automatic first down. It's just like, come on, man. These are sports people. It's a high, you know, it's a high profile game. Like they're playing on the edge. You know, they're highly strung. Like, what? Why have you got these rules where you're not allowed to taunt or you're not allowed to showboat? Come on,
man.
Like, sport.
That is half the crack. I'm telling you, look, especially Americans. Jesus Christ. You're going to get these lads going through high school, college, and in the NFL, getting jacked up, putting them on steads from the time they're 15. You expect them not to be in their phases. I've just found the kid's name. Curlon. Do you remember him?
Curlon? No, not at all.
No. Oh, my. I can't believe I've literally, the video I've just pulled up from YouTube is 15 years old. So that just shows you the era we're dealing with. Let's move.
Rocking around with a ball on his head.
Watch his highlights, man. I think it was his party trick, but he never went anywhere. Go on, let's move on.
All right. And lastly, in the Bundesliga, it comes as no surprise that Erling Braut Haaland, who we seem to mention every week, has scored another brace for Borussia Dortmund as they seem to keep their goal average above 3 a game. They've now scored 17 goals in 5 games in the Bundesliga, with Haaland helping himself to 7 goals and 3 assists in 5 games, which is incredible. It's not enough to put them top of the table, however, as Bayern Munich and Wolfsburg sit on 13 points. Bayern Munich amassing a 16-plus goal difference already in their 5 games. The 7-0 win against Bochum certainly helping towards a total from this weekend.
From what I read, in Haaland's 66 games for Dortmund, he's averaging a goal a game.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, something around those 60-odd, which, you know, and German League, you know, all right, it's not the Premier League. It's not the same sort of standard as Premier League, but I think there's still a lot of good teams in that German League that can compete across Europe. So, you know, it's not like he's scoring goals against Paraguayan national team that have no players in it. Do you know what I mean?
yeah, exactly.
I can barely kick a ball.
And look, so, don't get me wrong, like it is a top heavy league, but there are some, you know, Schalke got relegated last year, didn't they? But there's also like Hanover, Leipzig, you know.
Mönchengladbach, they're not a bad team. I think they've had some Champions League experience.
Yeah, you're not walking them teams, man. Obviously, like it's about commercialization, and we're more familiar with the Premier League. But, you know, Dortmund, Bayern Munich, they're the main two boys. But I still think the German league stronger than the Spanish league, for instance.
All right, so we're going to quickly rattle off a Ryder Cup preview that starts on Friday. So that'll be Friday, Saturday, Sunday between Europe and the US. So just a quick background to what it is. So begun in 1927, the Ryder Cup initially pitted the top professionals from the United States against their counterparts from Great Britain. But after Team USA spanked the Brits a few too many times, the English welcomed the Irish and later the rest of Europe into their ranks. So the move paid off, particularly in the last few Cups. Since 1993, Team Europe has won 9 times, with USA only winning 3 times, all at home. Team Europe is the defending champion after a thorough thrashing of the Americans, 17.5-10.5 in Paris in 2018. So the Ryder Cup takes place over 3 days of match play. First 2 days involve 2 sessions of 4 pairings apiece, and the final crucial Sunday comprises 12 single head-to-head matchups. So that's going to be going on Friday with 4 ball competitions, meaning pairs from each team will play their own ball from tee to cup. Whichever player scores the lowest wins the hole for his team. Are you going to be tuning into this, Jim?
I can't say I will, but you and Pizzy always hype me up for the golf. It's just a matter of time, isn't it, really? I mean, the one thing I've got on my sporting agenda this weekend is the fight, which we'll talk about later. This is a long-standing sporting thing, and I wish I was into it, man. I wish I was more into this. I wish I was more into Wimbledon. I wish I was more into loads of things that have this long-standing legitimacy. Well, I don't know where I'm going to find the time, man.
So that's it. There's so many sporting events, like, you know, on a weekend. Like, it's impossible. We've got 2 big fights. We've got obviously the fight. We've got a big UFC card this weekend. We've got the Ryder Cup going on the weekend. Then I added to all that, you got the football. Then you got the NFL. It's just impossible. And there's too many sports being thrown at us at one time, really, isn't there?
It is impossible. We're going to have to be more selective, I think. Not in terms of this, because obviously the Ryder Cup deserves a mention, man. Because it is a big deal. It's like the Ashes or something like that. That's what I would equivocate it to in my mind.
Yeah, and the Lions Tour of Australia sort of thing. So obviously this happens in a lot of different sports, doesn't it? Where there's sort of like a grouping of different athletes from different countries, and they come together and they, you know, they sort of like band together for this one tournament. So, and obviously biennial tournament. The teams this year, a little quick breakdown. Team USA have essentially got one of the best teams they've ever had. So it's going to be very, very difficult to knock them off the perch this year. I think they're 8-15 to win it. So the odds on to win. It's going to be in Wisconsin. So they're going to have a backing of all the American crowd. There's going to be no one from Europe there, save the people that are already living in the US because of coronavirus restrictions. So the automatic qualifiers for USA, Morikawa, Dustin Johnson, Bryson DeChambeau, and Brooks Koepka, who we're going to be intrigued to see their relationship. Hopefully they get paired together, because obviously we've spoke about their relationship over the last few months. Justin Thomas and Patrick Cantlay. The captain's picks, Tony Finau, Xander Schauffele, Jordan Spieth, Harris English, Daniel Berger, and Scotty Scheffler.
What is a captain's pick?
So essentially, Steve Stricker, who's the captain of Team USA, he has chose these golfers to be part of his team. There's six that get automatically qualified, I think, based on their FedEx Cup standings, basically how they performed over the last sort of year or 2 years. And then the captain picks six players who he thinks deserve a place on the team. So the Team Europe, their qualifiers, John Rahm, who's the number one golfer in the world, Tommy Fleetwood, Tyrell Hatton, Bernd Weisberger, Matthew Fitzpatrick, Rory McIlroy, Paul Casey, Victor Hovland, and Lee Westwood. So my bets of the weekend, I do fancy a cheeky little double. It was actually a special on Betfair. It's the two amateurs. So the two a leading amateur from both the USA and Team Europe. That's Colin Morikawa and Victor Hovland, the Norwegian. So a double for that would be 8-1. So I've had a little tenner on that. I've had a little tick on that. So hopefully that comes through.
So is that based on just the odds on their own, or the fact that John Rahm's world number one and he can lead the line?
Yeah, well, actually, he isn't world number one. I got that wrong. It's Dustin Johnson, but he will be world number one whenever they redo the rankings. I'm not sure when that is.
Oh, okay. De facto world number one.
Yeah, he is essentially. But yeah, so their odds are based on the fact that, you know, they're both kind of young. I think Morikawa is 24. I think Victor Hovland's around the same age. So, and they've sort of, they're amateurs in the teams. I think it's their first time. It's their first Ryder Cups as well. So 8-1 on that. It's worthwhile because Victor Hovland's been playing some great golf. Obviously, Morikawa, he's won two majors already at the age of 24.
I was just about to say about Morikawa, what did he win? You were telling me about that. Yeah, sorry. What did he win? What were the two majors that he won?
Yeah, he won the Open. He won the British Open this year. And he's already won, I believe, the US Open. So he's only got the PGA Championship he's won. So yeah, he's already won a couple of majors. So, you know, he's a golfer of the future. He, you know, potentially he could win. I don't want to say as many majors as Woods, but he's certainly on the right track already by winning.
Don't make those comparisons, man. You'll jinx him. And also he'll end up like shagging random birds in like an IHOP car park and his whole career will be destroyed.
No, you won't. Have you seen his missus? She's absolutely fire, mate.
Hi-oh for the boys.
So the last thing that I wanted to bring to your attention, Jim, so the Europe team, when they started making their shirts that they're going to wear, so they all wear the same shirts. It's like a team thing. It's kind of like, oh, we're all going to wear the same shirt. So they started developing this about 18 months ago, and they've got a company that specifically does it. But when they were going through designs, they knew that it was going to be, that the tournament's going to be held in Whistling Straits, I think it is, in Wisconsin. So the two teams that are in that area, so Wisconsin, you got Green Bay Packers, then obviously you got Chicago in Michigan. So the two states next to each other and their rivals. So because it's in Wisconsin, they wanted the sort of green and yellow. So Green Bay Packers playing green and yellow. So, and I think there's like an Irish connotation there. So the shirts are looking quite nice. But the strangest thing is when they came out for their sort of like introduction to the crowd earlier, they're wearing blocks of cheese on the red.
What the?
So, I don't know why this is, but Green Bay Packers and their fans, they're called cheeseheads. I think it's their nickname, you know, like the Zulus. Like they're cheeseheads, so they wear these just massive blocks of cheese on their head. I haven't done the research as to why
That is the Blues and Zulus comparison's perfect, man. Because why the fuck would you call Blues fans Zulus? And why the fuck would you call Packers fans cheeseheads, man? And I can't believe they took it to the literal nth degree and came out with blocks. It's like, come up with something else, man. Come up with something else. Oh, that's dead.
I could be wrong, but are the Blues hooligans, are they not called the Zulus because of the massive African-American contingent in the fan base?
The Blues fans?
Yeah. Is that because the Midlands clubs, West Brom, Blues, not really Villa. They had a lot of when they used to go away to, you know, way to different teams in the 70s and 80s, people were shocked. A lot of clubs from London were shocked to see it, the amount of you know, blacks and Asians that were in the fan base. And I think born from that.
You know where that comes from? From the Michael Caine film Zulu.
Might be. Yeah.
No, that's always been, obviously I didn't want to just drop that like willy-nilly film knowledge, like, but I've never watched the film, but I've always been peripherally aware of it, and it's on the watch list sometime soon, actually. Zulu, where Michael Caine plays a fucking English army man, and then they make their last stand against the Zulus coming in. So that's where I thought it came from. But now you just made me want to watch Zulu. Like, fuck all this sports shit, man. I might just allow it. Like,
I might just dip off this podcast. Can't watch Zulu right now.
But yeah.
Right. Are we on the quiz time?
We are indeed, and I've got my quizzes ready. You haven't looked at the questions, have you?
No, I wouldn't do that, man. I wouldn't do that. Right. I was tempted because of my poor performance. Man. I was just looking at. I could see it on the drive. I was like, should I just look at one? I'll hide the rest. I'll look at one. See. Just make sure I get 1 point. But no, I haven't done it. I wouldn't do that.
You're an honest man, and this is what I love doing the podcast with you. You're absolutely trustworthy on this shit. So I'll pull up the questions now.
So we're going all 30 seconds for these ones, or have I got a longer one?
No, you've got all 30 seconds. I've allowed the bonus questions for the sake of clarity, and we'll get there now, I think.
So how many points have we got available? Because I'll give you like, I'll give you like 12 and a half points availability last week. And if you're only giving me five, that's a bit harsh, isn't it?
I think we can sort out the ratios, man, to be fair, because this is you've got 3 points available for question five, and the rest of them are a point each.
All right, so there you go. 8, that'll do.
Okay, so let me just get up the questions now. Whoa, I look at my neighbours who are looking at me funny because I've got the fucking microphone up. Okay, so for the quiz this week, are you ready? You've got 30 seconds primed.
I'm ready. So as soon as you finish the question, yeah?
As soon as I finish the question, okay, yeah. I'm going to start now. Question one. My beloved Atlanta Falcons went 0-2 for the season last weekend with a 48-25 loss to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Can you tell me when the Falcons last won the Super Bowl, and for a bonus point, who they beat?
Oh, shit. That's a good question, man. Right. It's definitely not in since I've been watching. I'm going to go somewhere in the 2000s. I'm going to go 2005 and against the Green Bay Packers.
I'm sorry, man. That is incorrect. Would you like to know the answer now?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, so they last won it in 1999 and they beat the Vikings.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's been, what, 22 years? That's a pretty long sabbatical from winning
you
the year.
You were right, man. The Falcons are fucking atrocious, man. I can't believe it. All right. So...
Tom Brady got five touchdowns, didn't they?
Mate, absolutely Tom Brady smashing it. Who's that? Gronkowski, mate.
Yeah.
What the fuck is going on there?
Because they were together at Patriots as well, New England Patriots. So they've just been smashing it together for like ages.
When did Gronkowski go there? I'm getting interested now.
He retired, right? For a year. And then Brady left Patriots, went to Tampa Bay and was like, Rob, come on, Rob. Come back, man. Come back. We'll go and win a Super Bowl. And they did.
I'm way more interested in the conversations about the NFL than I am in the actual NFL because I think it's fucking important. Anyway, we're on the quiz. So, question number two. Liverpool's Mo Salah and Sadio Mane both recently hit their Premier League centuries. Their attacking partner, Roberto Firmino, is also closing in on his 100. How many goals away is he?
Oh man, these are fucking hard questions. He's closing in on it, so could be anywhere between 1 and 20 goals, couldn't it? Really, that'd be closing in.
I will say you're absolutely correct in that assumption.
All right, I'm gonna go. So he's got. Do you want how many goals he's got left, or how many he's got?
How many goals he's got left until he reaches 100?
All right, 7.
12, mate. Ah! Unlucky. Unlucky. All right. I tried to steer you in the right direction. Sorry, man. And I'll tell you this right now. I'll be shocked if you don't get this one. So, question number three.
Pressure's on.
The Ryder Cup commences tomorrow. Can you tell me what year it began?
We had it earlier, didn't we? 1927.
Well done. Ding, yes. Ding, ding. Yes. When I was reading that, yeah, I was gutted.
You were fuming, man. He's got it in the fucking... He's actually did some research.
I was like, the fucking bastard, but well done. Well done.
I've got to get 2 points from these last couple, though, to even your score from last week.
To be fair, question five's cricket, so we'll see.
Oof, okay.
Question number four. Anthony Joshua is set to defend his unified World Heavyweight Championship on Saturday against Alexander Usyk. Who did he beat to win his first world title back in 2016?
Well, that Klitschko.
I'll give you another guess. Because that weren't really a guess, was it? That was like a rhetorical question.
His first world title.
Just make sure the time is running. So.
Yeah, it is running. 10 seconds left. Obviously, he won all his belts back off Andy Ruiz after he lost. That was 2018, 2019, wasn't it? Oh, I don't know. When was Klitschko then? It's gone.
Sorry, man. That was a bit boxing specific. I thought you might have been like up on it when it happened.
Yeah.
The guy's name was Charles Martin.
Ah, you know, the guy with the dreads.
Yeah.
I know. I didn't realize he won a title off him. I remember the fight. Yeah, I remember the fight. He beat him in like the first round, didn't he, or something?
Second, I think.
Yeah, quite early. I remember him fighting the geezer, but I didn't realize that was for a title. Yeah.
I'm glad that's not an absolute mystery. Yeah. All right, good. Okay, so question number five. And here is, we'll see how you get on because this might be a bit specific. So question number five. England's cricket team cancelled their visit to Pakistan this week due to the classic mental health concerns for their players. The two countries have played each other 189 times across all formats since 1954. I'll give you a point for telling me the leader in each category. So that's Test, One Day Internationals and T20 Internationals.
All right.
The leader in each one. I don't need the number. I just need you to tell me who's winning.
England are leading in T20s.
Nice. Yeah, 1 point.
Pakistan are leading in Test.
Incorrect.
Pakistan leading in One Days.
Incorrect again.
Ah, England leading all three.
England are leading all three. I'll give you the stats right now. So in the Test, it's 26-21 to England. One Day Internationals, it's 56-33 to England.
So that's close.
And T20s, it's 12-5 for England.
Yeah, I was pretty sure I was certain on the T20s. I thought Pakistan might have edged the Tests. And then because they were both England, I thought, all right, one's got to be Pakistan.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was a nice curveball, man. Yeah. It's a curveball, man. So
the two, yeah. It's only two this week. So you win again. Okay. No, that was a good quiz. That was a good one. I feel like I had a better performance that week than I have done in previous ones.
You were very close on a couple of them, and I'm really happy that you actually know who Charles Martin was, and you weren't like, who the fuck was that? Like,
No, I remember him fighting the geezer. I wouldn't have thought, because like he absolutely smacked the geezer up, and to be fair, Charles Martin didn't look like he had any business like owning a title. So like that's kind of what I did think of it. It did flash in my head. Because I thought it was about that era as well. That's 2016. But
we're going to talk a little bit about Anthony Joshua in a little bit. But
absolutely,
a little bit of a lackluster MMA review to begin the combat.
Combat.
A little bit of a lackluster MMA review. To
a
begin
little
the
bit
combat
of a
sport. A little bit of a bubble. So the combat sports section this week. Pretty dead week last week for MMA, especially. Anthony Smith submits Ryan Spann in the first round on Sunday. Nothing more to report except for a bit of afters, really. Bit silly. If you want to watch it on YouTube, go check it out. Yoel Romero, former interim middleweight UFC champion, soundly beaten in his Bellator debut at light heavyweight by Phil Davis. The 44-year-old Cuban fought at that weight class for the first time in 10 years and looked badly outsized. Davis just put on a classic MMA display, mixing in punches and kicks with takedowns, basically overwhelmed Romero with activity. And just a little tidbit for that. Romero, despite his defeat, was still the highest paid athlete on the card that night. But that's all just a precursor to what's going on this weekend. UFC 266, headlined by Alexander Volkanovski versus Brian Ortega for the featherweight title. Co-main event, Valentina Shevchenko versus Lauren Murphy for the bantamweight belt. And rounding out the head of the card will be Robbie Lawler versus the returning Nick Diaz in a rematch from their cult classic from UFC 47, which happened all the way back in 2004. I was 13 when that happened. So, mate, what do you think of this card?
I mean, there is a couple of title fights there to whet the appetite, isn't there? Shevchenko, huge favourite to beat Lauren Murphy, so I guess we won't anticipate any upsets there. Volkanovski, Ortega, I think should be more of an interesting one, shouldn't it? Both only one defeat each. Volkanovski coming off the back of two hard-fought title defences over Max Holloway, both of which went the distance. Ortega was actually beaten by Max Holloway back in 2018 before his win over the Korean zombie, Sung Chung Chan. So I'm interested to get your thoughts on how you think that one in particular plays out.
I think Ortega's going to do him over, man. The two fights against Max Holloway, the first one, Volkanovski probably won. The second one, I think Max Holloway definitely won. And then you got to examine Volkanovski's ledger before that. Jose Aldo, he's a Don, all-time great, still racking up good wins at bantamweight, but probably past his peak as an elite-level performer. Before that, Chad Mendes, Darren Elkins, Shane. Before that, there is nothing to incite any kind of excitement about Volkanovski's, about his ledger, about his potential. So I think Max Holloway was probably just a good style matchup for him. And then you look at Brian Ortega, and then you look at, again, a common opponent, what Max Holloway did to him. Max Holloway made him look, he didn't belong in there with him, absolutely tore him up. His striking was rudimentary in that match compared to Holloway. And then you see him against the Korean zombie, and he looked like a different man. So I think it's a one-dimensional aspect we're looking at it from here. I think the one thing we're not considering is Brian Ortega's submissions are really dangerous. And I think when it comes to Volkanovski's style, when it comes to his height disadvantage, when it comes to how he's aggressive and he stays low, which is what I watched Dan Hardy's breakdown of it, and it made a lot of sense to me. He switches up his rhythm. He might fire a jab, then shoot for a takedown. You can't shoot for takedowns on Ortega because he's submission. Like what most people would call like a headlock, right? That's a guillotine in jiu-jitsu where they move the hand across the front of the throat and they kind of wrench it up to literally suffocate someone. And if someone's really quick and can snap that in at a moment's notice, then you're in trouble. So I think that's going to make Volkanovski hesitant, really. I think Brian Ortega wins this all day. But again, man, it's so, so difficult to predict the UFC, man. You don't know if someone's going to chop their leg. You don't know if someone's going to get cut. You don't know if someone's going to get ground and pound. But if there was a gun to my head, I'd say Brian Ortega for sure, man.
You've already convinced me and I've already put it on my bet slip. So elsewhere on the card, there's an intriguing fight between Curtis Blaydes and Jairzinho Rozenstruik. There are two fighters in the heavyweight division that are around about in contention for title shots at Ngannou. I think one's fourth in the rankings, one's sixth. So this should be a good scrap. And would this propel Curtis Blaydes back into contention after his defeat to Derek Lewis last time out?
I would hope so. Because you deserve a lot of credit if you beat Rozenstruik. You can't fuck about with that kid, man. He's a one-hitter quitter, man. And again, he might not be... I think Rozenstruik's quite similar to Derek Lewis in that his takedown defense is quite good. He's not going to submit you. He's not going to do anything too strategic in that sense. But he's got a really long history of kickboxing. He kicks like a fucking mule. And you cannot stand in front of him. And I think Curtis Blaydes is in a lot of trouble here because he looks to take people down.
So that's really intriguing, man. No, perfect, because I'm going to put that in the bet slip as well because he's good odds. He's like 3.4. So, you know, if you think that he's got similar, you know, attributes to Derek Lewis and he can sort of go about his fight tactically in the same way, then as you say, Curtis Blaydes is going to be in trouble. So I'm going to slap him on the bet slip as well. So
even... This is a lot of pressure. This is a lot of pressure for me now, Bishop. Don't be putting big money on this.
Even for a double, and I'm working the odds off kind of at the top of my head, but 3.4, so you put 20 quid on that, it's kind of like 2.5. Look, you're looking at like a 6-1 double for those two. So I think that's probably worthwhile doing. You know what I mean?
You're making me doubt my own predictions right now. But the one I actually think is going to happen is Ortega against Volkanovski, man. I think Volkanovski beating Holloway was the right style matchup. And I think Ortega is the wrong style matchup. I'll just leave it there, isn't it? Not going in too quick. But the boxing preview, this is the one we want to talk about, and it really... AJ Usyk, man. Outdoors, Tottenham Hotspur's ground. If AJ wins the Tyson Fury fight, it's supposed to happen. But who knows, man? You know what boxing's like. There could be two or three mandatories in the way. But this is the narrative. If Usyk wins, it's going to be something historic. What do you think?
I don't think it's going to be on the levels of shock of when Andy Ruiz beat Joshua. obviously that was like a massive shot, wasn't it? When he won those titles, and then they were quickly sort of snatched back.
I disagree with you there. You know,
you think this would be more of a shock? I mean, going by the way the betting's going, it certainly wouldn't be as much of a shock. But do you think that there's more chance of Usyk doing damage than there was of sort of Andy Ruiz springing that surprise that he did a few years ago?
I'll tell you why I disagree with that is because you look at, I'm going through Anthony Joshua's record now. After you fought Charles Martin, Dominic Brazil, Eric Molina.
Yeah, was that before Charles Martin? Because Takam caused him a few problems as well.
No, we'll get to that in a minute. But let's Charles Martin. He wins the title off him in 2016, the IBF. And that's when he starts his road to the Undisputed, which is still incomplete as of yet. Charles Martin's not a top-level fighter by anyone's standards. Dominic Brazil, he made his name off being like an ex-football player, kind of got on the PBC, if memory serves correct. I might be wrong there, but just a big, tough guy, not a elite-level boxer. Eric Molina, he earned his stripes by going 9 rounds with Deontay Wilder, which is no mean feat, don't get me wrong, because we all know what Deontay Wilder can do with his right hand. And then we get to the Klitschko fight. So we're looking at, he's won his title, he's got 2 average defences, and then he fights, for me, some people might laugh at this, but I think Vladimir Klitschko is an all-time great. And the manner that he beat him in, and the fact that he got up off the floor, and he emptied the tank in the 11th, and he got his bollocks out that night, man. Do you know what I mean? And I really admire Joshua for what he did that night. It was absolutely astounding. I don't think anyone can take that away from him. I'll be honest with you. Anthony Joshua annoys me in terms of like, oh, be humble. I'm your best mate. Da, 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 da. I think he's a serious cunt and he just has to disguise that for commercial purposes. Do you know what I mean? But that Vladimir Klitschko fight, no one can ever take that away from him. But the point that I'm getting to, Carlos Takam after that, a very small heavyweight, not a lot of punching power. He gave Joshua problems, man. And that stoppage in that fight wasn't great at all, man. At all. People were booing. People were booing that stoppage. And that was in the 10th round. I didn't think Takam looked in trouble. Then you go Joseph Parker again. Probably he fought Andy Ruiz, edged the decision in New Zealand. You can probably take that as Andy Ruiz winning. Alexander Povetkin. Alexander Povetkin went on to chin Dillian White, who's still a top 5 heavyweight to this day. And then you get to Andy Ruiz. Do you know what I mean? So you've got a couple of no marks in there. Klitschko, all-time great. And then you've got smaller heavyweights causing him problems. All right. So I think Andy Ruiz and Takam, stylistically, they're a problem for Joshua anyway. So styles make fights is what I'm getting at. Stylistically, they're always going to be a problem for him. I don't think Usyk is that much smaller than Joshua, right? And I think he stands up with him. I think Usyk stands up tall. He's not coming in low. Joshua's basically got the fight the way he wants it. So if Usyk is able to turn the fight to his advantage, I think that's a much greater achievement than what Andy Ruiz was able to accomplish. And you know what? I was watching the highlights of Usyk versus Belew the other day. And I think Usyk's left hand is going to be a real problem for him. It's a sneaky punch, man. It's a sneaky punch. And if he carries on clipping him and leads it with the right hook, kind of uses his lead hand, his right hand as a wand. I think Joshua's got serious problems there. But on the other hand, I don't think you can discount the size difference because historically, you can go all the way back to Bob Foster in the 70s fighting Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali. You can go back to Billy Kahn fighting Joe Lewis in the 1940s, man. There's a whole host of light heavyweights, cruiserweights, that moved up to heavyweight to try to get the bag. And the only man that's ever done it with any amount of success is Evander Holyfield, and he's 1 in a million. So I don't think history is on the side of Usyk, but I also think Usyk is an exceptional talent.
So in that, you know, after that great, great detailed breakdown, I certainly wouldn't be leaning to have a bet on Usyk. I'm always trying to use your information to try and make a little buck for myself. But also talking about the fight and how we actually think it's going to pan out. Obviously, I don't know how many Southpaw style fighters that Joshua's come up against, but how much of the sort of training regime and his training camp, his preparation for this fight, how much of time does that take up? How much time does he have to dedicate to dealing with that problem, that tactical problem? Does it really make that much of a difference, or does he still have more focus on making sure he's in the right shape, and his weight training regime is spot on, and making sure that he's tuned in? How much how does he divide up his time and in his preparation?
I think the last Southpaw he fought was Charles Martin. So that was quite a few years ago.
Five years ago.
And also, you got to take into consideration for a potential opponent, do they switch hit? Do they go lefty? Do they go righty? Someone like Terence Crawford goes left and right all the time, depending on the situation. Usyk is not going to be switching. He's a left-handed fighter, the same way Joshua's a right-handed fighter. Joshua knows what he's doing, man. He's going to have left-handed sparring partners in there. Maybe a few switch hitters, and they're just going to tell him to stay lefty. He knows what he's doing. He's a professional. I don't think the stance is going to be as big of a problem as the timing of Usyk. The first thing he did in that Tony Bellew fight, which really caught my eye. Sometimes fighters come out with a really big punch, or they come out with a really hard jab, or they do like something really impactful. The first thing Usyk did against Bellew was he threw a massive feint. He made Bellew flinch. So he was like, all right, I got that. And he just put that to the back of his brain. So that's the kind of level he's operating on. So, he's looking for reactions and he's logging the reactions. He's like, all right, I'll try that again in two rounds. That's the kind of level Usyk's operating on. So whether that kind of mentality is enough to combat AJ's size, we'll see, man. But I've got a sneaky feeling about Usyk. Definitely.
Really intriguing matchup. What else is going on that undercard?
I don't think the undercard's all that, really. I'm interested in Lawrence Okolie. I think people are going to struggle to beat him at cruiserweight. I think he's like 6'5", 6'6". He's done a lot of sparring with AJ in the past. He's fighting Dylan Prasevich. People say he's boring. People said that about Johnny Nelson, but he had 14 WBO defenses and is widely considered one of the best cruiserweights of all time. So you just got to look at Okolie's title win against Glowacki in March, I think it was. And he's now under Shane McGuigan, looking way more mobile on his feet. And I think Prasevich is in trouble here, to be honest. But as to be expected, he's got a good record. I think he's 15-0, 11 knockouts, something like that. This is one to bolster up the card. But you can't expect the undercard to be that big when you're paying AJ his money and Usyk his money. And the other one's Callum Smith, coming back at light heavyweight after his defeat to Canelo under a new trainer, Buddy McGirt. I can't remember who's fighting at the moment, but those are the only two undercard fights I'm dealing with. I think Mardu, the light welterweight as well, who's been talking up a fight with Conor Benn. That's the only things to break out. But honestly, if you're in the UK, I think the main event's at 10:30. Tune in about 8:30, 9 o'clock. That's your best bet.
Yeah, and if you're on this side of the Atlantic, you get it even better because you get to watch the Joshua fight around about, 6:30 probably. So you might be able to catch the undercard about, 4:30, 5 o'clock, the two undercard fights that are worth watching. And then you got Joshua, and then you get the UFC that should be on around midnight with the main card starting around then.
Inshallah.
Perfect. My Saturday night is absolutely made for me.
I'm so jealous of you, right? I wish you didn't say that,
I'm going to get about 12 beers, sit in the house, probably have a takeaway or something, maybe a pizza, just mong out on the sofa all night.
Mate, I wish I was there with you, man. I'm so screwing right now, man, that you've just said that. Beers and pizza and UFC before 12 o'clock.
Yeah, because you've got to put the fucking hard yards in it, to stay up for the UFC, five in the morning things.
I'll watch it the next morning for illegal means, allegedly, but still.
All right, that'll round it up for this week. Make sure you check us out on social media, as always. We're having a bit more of a presence on YouTube and Twitter, as it is. We're trying to put up a few more videos on the Insta as well, just to make sure that we're sort of getting our ugly mugs on all the socials. Right, thank you once again, Jim, for you sharing your amazing insight on the boxing, because you've given me a few tips. And I'm hoping, I might even have a treble, man. I might have the treble. Those two, who did we say? Ortega, we said Rosenstroik and Usyk. That treble is probably going to be about over 12 to 1, maybe even 16 to 1. You have a tenner on that, that will give you 170 smackaroonies right in your back pocket.
You know what? I'm feeling the pressure right now, but I also don't think that bet is out of the realms of possibility.
So if you don't think that, then that's a great, in my opinion, that's a good bet. I'm going to stick on. I might have the double with the two UFC fighters, and then I might have a treble, just throw Usyk in there just in case. But as you say, man, Joshua, you never know what's going to happen with this geezer. And he hasn't really, as you say, he hasn't really been tested apart from that Klitschko fight. He's come up against a few heavyweights that, you know, he expected to beat easily. He's had that one loss against Andy Ruiz where he looked like a different person. Who knows what's going to happen in that fight?
We're Thursday. We're 2 days away from the fight, and I literally want to stop talking about it now because I think I have got a sneaky feeling about Usyk, man. Obviously, the bigger man often wins, but I've got a sneaky feeling about Usyk, man. For sure.
We are not condoning you to waste your money, but
yeah, don't waste your money. But just, you know,
you could invest 10 quid in worse things. That's all I'm saying. All right, great episode once again. Thank you, Jim, and we'll see each other next Thursday.
Always a pleasure, brother.